Welcome to SCOTUScast, a project of the Federalist Society for Law and Public Policy Studies. Our contributors join us from around the country to bring you expert commentary on U.S. Supreme Court cases as they are argued and decisions are issued. The Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker.
Hello and welcome to SCOTUScast. I'm your host, Justin Drewer, on behalf of the Faculty Division of the Federalist Society. We're here today to discuss the decision handed down on February 28th in Delaware v. Pennsylvania and Wisconsin. It's my honor to introduce our guest today, Professor Adam McLeod. Professor McLeod is a professor of law at Faulkner University's Thomas Good Jones School of Law, where he teaches courses concerning property, intellectual property, jurisprudence, and private law theory. He's also a senior scholar and former Thomas Edison Fellow at the Center for Intellectual Property and Innovation Policy at George Mason University, and a research fellow for the Center for Religion, Culture, and Democracy. And we're very happy to have him join us on SCOTUScast today. So thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Justin. Looking forward to it.
So I guess to start us off, can we touch briefly on the background of the case, kind of a quick summary just to refresh our listeners' memories, given that it's been a while since oral argument? Before we get into the decision.
Well, it's a case of original jurisdiction in the Supreme Court, a dispute between states, and it's been hanging around for several years. The case has been referred to a special master many years ago. The special master, after arguments and objections to the findings, made a subsequent set of findings to which there were further objections. And so it's been round and round in terms of findings and briefings over the years. The basic question in the case is, what do you do with intangible property when no one claims it? And with tangible property, the general rule of thumb is the rule of situs. It escheats to the state where the stuff is found, whether that's, you know, automobiles or equipment or furniture or whatever. With intangible property, obviously, that's a little more complicated. So the court took up this question with respect to various financial instruments, which are sort of in the nature of checks or negotiable instruments. And the question was whether they're like or similar to money orders. The reason for that is there are two different rules in federal law for escheatment for intangible property that can travel across state lines. There's a rule that was announced in the Supreme Court's 1965 decision in Texas versus New Jersey, the rule that the court consistently has referred to as the common law rule. It's not, for reasons we'll get into. But that rule is that where the creditor, the creditor's location or domicile is known, it's the state of the creditor's domicile to which the unclaimed intangible assets escheat. When unknown, it's the place of the debtor's incorporation. So in a case of like a Wells Fargo, for example, that would be New York. In the case of MoneyGram, which is the financial institution that's at stake in this case, it would be Delaware. Congress responded to that decision in Texas, New Jersey a few years later with the Federal Disposition Act, which essentially abrogated Texas versus New Jersey and said, no, these assets should escheat to the state where the instruments were purchased. So if someone goes into their Wells Fargo office and purchases one of these money orders, say in an office in Birmingham, Alabama, and then the money is not claimed at the other end of the transfer, and they can't find the purchaser back in Birmingham, then they would escheat to Alabama. They limited it, Congress did, to instruments that were either money orders or similar written instruments is the term of art. And then they also accepted something that they called third-party bank checks. And so in Delaware versus Pennsylvania, what the Supreme Court is trying to figure out is what all these terms mean. What are the similarities and differences between these various instruments, money orders, similar written instruments that are similar to money orders, How do they differ from third-party bank checks, if at all? And therefore, and that, of course, determines whether to use the rule of Texas versus New Jersey, or rather the rule of the Federal Disposition Act.
All right. So I guess segueing to the decision, is there anything kind of interesting that that happened in the decision's reasoning, or anything surprising, I guess, given that it was a unanimous vote?
Yeah. Well, the case is really interesting, and I think really important for the way in which the court reasoned. The holding of the case, you know, may not have much interest to anyone who's not interested in the concept of escheatment, or interested in the technicalities of how different financial instruments differ from each other. But the reasoning of the court is really interesting here. Justice Jackson writes the opinion for the court. As you said, it's unanimous. Interestingly, it's unanimous as for the entire opinion and holding, of course, except part 4B of the opinion. And the reason why that's not unanimous, I'll get to in just a second. The bit of background, just sort of telescoping out to the court's jurisprudence a little more generally to explain why I think this is interesting. You know, for the last half century or so, of course, the court has been sort of stuck in what I would call a dichotomous way of interpreting legal texts. So you might call, on one hand, sort of the legal pragmatist view, or the view of judicial supremacy, that the Constitution and statutes mean what the court says they mean. Bit oversimplified, but for the sake of discussion. And then on the other side, what emerged as a response to that was a textualist approach, plain meaning approach, what some critics of textualism call strict textualism, characterized by a reticence of the court to look at classical legal concepts or natural law principles or legislative history, just stay within the four corners of the instrument. In recent decades, of course, the court has obsolesced a lot of this dichotomous way of legal interpretation by looking to more classical ways of legal interpretation. So in the constitutional context of fundamental rights, you can think about the court's history and tradition test for identifying unenumerated rights, which looks an awful lot like the classical juristic way of talking about fundamental rights that are part of immemorial usage, right? From a time when the memory of man runneth not to the contrary. You can look at the way the court has thought about the distinction between public and private rights in the patent law context, in the administrative law context, and drawing on Justinian and Blackstone and Matthew Hale, cyber trespass, you know, looking at classical property concepts. So this sort of more classical way of interpreting legal texts slices through the middle of this dichotomy between legal pragmatism, judicial supremacy on one side, and a sort of rigorous textualism on the other. That none of that classical juristic way of interpreting found its way into this case. And that's largely owing to the briefs of the parties. The case was essentially presented as a dichotomy between these two sort of more 20th century ways of thinking. The legal pragmatist view, which is evidenced in the court's decision in Texas versus New Jersey, where the court says essentially, well, we're just going to pick a test. And we're going to pick a test for very pragmatic reasons. We're going to make it easier for financial institutions to keep records and reduce information costs and those sorts of classical scientific, you know, economic ways of thinking about how courts go about picking tests. And then on the other hand, the interpretive tool offered is plain meaning textualism. Well, we can look at the Federal Disposition Act. We can look at these terms of art. We can just infer from the text and the internal evidence within the statute what these terms mean. That in the end is the method that Justice Jackson and the other justices chose. The opinion, with the exception of part 4B, is a straightforward textualist analysis, and they end up holding that these instruments, which are at issue in this particular case, are in fact, though not money orders, similar enough to money orders that they come within the Federal Disposition Act, and they are not third-party bank checks, and therefore are not excluded from the coverage of the Federal Disposition Act, and so therefore, when they're unclaimed, they escheat to the state where they were purchased. The court, however, recognizes that these terms that it's interpreting, particularly the exception, the term of, for the exception to the rule covering third-party bank checks, is not defined in the statute. It's not a legal term of art. It's extremely ambiguous. And so I would argue, Delaware certainly argued, that that a plain meaning approach to the text fails in this case. You can't really discern from the text what that term means. So in part 4B of the opinion, Justice Jackson turns to legislative history. Significantly, this part is not joined by Justices Thomas, Alito, Gorsuch, and Barrett. It is joined by the other four justices. And Justice Jackson reasons that the legislative history supports supports what she takes to be the plain meaning of the Federal Disposition Act, which encompasses these check instruments, which are at issue in Delaware versus Pennsylvania, in within the meaning of the term money order or similar written instrument.
So in terms of the implications of the decision going forward, do you see more implications, I guess, jurisprudentially than you know, more concretely in terms of how intangible property will be disposed of, or and I guess kind of or along that jurisprudential line, I guess, do you see this as further confirmation of Justice Kagan's famous declaration that everyone is a textualist now? You know, is a if you can expand a little bit on the implications going forward, that would be great, because it sounds like it's teed up to have some.
Yes. No, I think the big takeaway from this case, which has broader implication, not just within the realm of intangible property and rules governing disposition of intangible property that moves interstate, but the bigger, the first I'd mention the broader implication for legal interpretation and legal interpretive methods, because there were resources, classical juristic resources, that the parties could have presented to the court, which I think would have avoided this sort of dichotomy between the judicial supremacist approach of Texas versus New Jersey and a plain meaning approach, which really is I think unpersuasive when the term doesn't really have any apparent plain meaning. So you can look, for example, at the jus commune, the sort of the law of nations that's shared by custom and convention and reason across national boundaries. You know, escheatment is a power of sovereigns. So you could talk about the classical conception of sovereignty. It's not actually grounded in the power to make law ex nihilo. Laws aren't made ex nihilo in the classical conception of the jus gentium. There's customary law and natural law, which precedes positive law. What sovereignty is ultimately grounded in is the right, the power and the duty of a sovereign to protect a particular territory and the people who are part of that territory. This, of course, points away from the rule of Texas versus New Jersey, which favors the law of incorporation of the debtor, and points toward concepts, classical juristic concepts like nationality, or in our tradition, we would say domicile, the domicile of the owner of the property. And then you can read the Federal Disposition Act as simply declaratory of those classical juristic concepts and say, no, it makes sense that Congress would have chosen the place of purchase because that's the last known domicile of the creditor. You get the same you get the same sort of reasoning out of the common law. Chosen action is the right which is at stake here, and a chosen action is precisely the right that's created when a bailor creates a bailment by entrusting a tangible good to a bailee. It's the exact same right. It could be treated exactly the same way. And again, the Federal Disposition Act looks like it's declaratory of the law of bailments, where the bailment has entrusted some tangible thing to the bailee for delivery to another person, and that person doesn't accept the bailment. The bailee has a duty to return the item back to the bailor, just like a money order, just like a check, a negotiable instrument. The duty is to return that that intangible resource back to the person who made the purchase at the point of origin. And so on either of these accounts, using classical juristic concepts, legal concepts, you can read the congressional enactment as simply declaratory of those concepts, and it makes it make a lot more sense. It helps to make clear and elucidate Congress's rationality. And I would argue it actually helps to make clear this ambiguous term that no one bothered to define in the statute, third-party bank checks. Because what is a third party? Well, in the context of bailment, it's someone who has no rights with respect to the bailment. Just tertiary, right, is the legal concept there. And so even that part can be understood as simply declaratory. So I think what the lesson or takeaway here is that the court, as it has increasingly moved toward more classical juristic ways of interpreting texts over the last decade or so, the bar hasn't caught up yet. And this was really a missed opportunity, I think. These are very, very able lawyers. We're talking about state attorneys general and folks who have argued a lot before the Supreme Court of the United States. But these classical juristic concepts really, I think, could be used very fruitfully in more mundane cases, you might say, like this one, rather in addition to the cases where we're arguing about the meaning of, you know, unenumerated substantive due process rights and those sorts of things. And so I think there's a lot of fruit to be harvested there.
Thank you for that. That was a good unpacking. So I guess kind of rounding us out towards the end of the episode, are there any additional things you'd like to touch on, or do you think we've unpacked it well?
Well, one more thing, which you mentioned earlier, obviously money orders and bank checks are not the only forms of intangible property. And so, of course, the court, this case does have doctrinal implications, potential doctrinal implications for the way that the court thinks about fundamental property rights with respect to intellectual property, whether that's federal statutory intellectual property or common law property like trade secrets, resources in cyber law, and the way that the court goes about thinking about how those intangible resources are governed across state and national boundaries. Again, you know, if you adhere to a strictly textualist approach to some of the federal and international laws, sometimes those textual interpretation tools are going to have limits, are going to let you down at the margins. And so, again, I think it's an opportunity for lawyers to think more broadly about the way in which some of these positive enactments in a variety of contexts which concern intangible resources, they could be clarified by a more classical juristic way of interpreting them.
All right, Professor McLeod, thank you very much for breaking down the case and making what you're right would otherwise be quite a mundane issue over money orders something very very interesting and far-reaching. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Justin.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. SCOTUS Cast is a project of the Federalist Society, a not-for-profit educational organization of conservative and libertarian law students, law professors, and lawyers, founded upon the principles that the state exists to preserve freedom, that the separation of governmental powers is central to our Constitution, and that it is emphatically the province and duty of the judiciary to say what the law is, not what it should be. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast series, including SCOTUS Cast and Practice Group Podcasts, on iTunes or Google Play. For an archive of past podcasts, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at fedsoc.org/multimedia. That's fedsoc.org/multimedia.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.